Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 130 with the title From Tech to D&I Transformation. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Toby Milden. Toby is a workplace inclusion specialist. And when I asked Toby to describe his superpower, he said that he takes the scariness out of EDI and makes it practical and easy to implement. Hello, Toby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joanne. Thanks for inviting me along. It's lovely to be with you today.
Yeah, we met many years ago at the National Cybersecurity Centre near Victoria in London, didn't we? I think that's the first time we actually met in person.
Yeah, it was donkeys years ago. And then I think I realised that we're also both fellows of the Royal Society of Arts. So I spotted you on their website, or their, you know, they've got a database, don't they, of fellows. And I know that we've had several cups of tea at RSA House in London.
We have. Yeah, we have. That was PC, wasn't it? Pre-COVID. So back in the old days.
That was pre-COVID, when it was perfectly acceptable to meet somebody for a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it was. Now we have to socially distance all. Should we do it online or do it on Zoom? Yeah. So Toby, tech to D&I transformation. Tell me more about what you do and how you take the scariness out of EDI.
Yeah, so that scariness out of EDI actually was some feedback that we received recently from one of our clients. They said that we take a lot of the anxiety and the fear out of talking about EDI, which we see a lot with senior leaders and businesses. They're worried about saying the wrong thing, causing offense, causing embarrassment. They're concerned about a cancel culture, particularly if they're a senior leader where they have got status in the organization. But in terms of tech to D&I transformation, I think it's based on my personal experience, which is similar to yours, really, in that when I left university, I spent the first half of my career working in technology and working on tech transformation projects. So I was an IT consultant for Accenture. I then moved into healthcare technology, implementing software into hospitals, and ended up at the BBC as a technical project manager on the redevelopment of the news website, the development of what is now the BBC Sounds app, and lots of accessibility projects. And then I pivoted my career when I was at the BBC. I mean, between you and me, I was getting a bit bored working on websites and apps. And I used to work really closely with the management team of our technology and engineering department. And they were concerned at the time about the gender imbalance that we had in tech compared to the rest of the BBC, where there was a bit more of an even gender split. And they created a plan to get more women into technology initially. And they needed a project manager to run that plan. And I put my hand up and volunteered to do that. It started off as a part-time job, one day a week, and then I quickly realized it was actually a full-time occupation. There were some really valuable lessons. I quickly learned that diversity was much bigger than women in engineering, that there are many other aspects to diversity that needed addressing in the corporation. And so that's how my transition happened.
Yeah, I had a similar epiphany, I think, when I started doing this work around EDI. I thought it was all about me when I started, all about this one sort of micro bit. And then you realize it's actually about everybody. Mm. And I always, the phrase I always say is, if everybody can succeed, everybody is welcome, everyone can thrive, I'm part of everybody. So that benefits me and people and all people. And we don't need to narrow it down just to one specific strand or thread or characteristic. And it's important to create the culture where everyone can succeed, isn't it?
Yeah, I think a lot of organizations, though, begin with those single strands, unfortunately. It's one of the misconceptions that I think you and I need to bust in the work that we do. There seems to be this kind of siloed thinking, or certainly a hierarchical approach to EDI. So a lot of organizations say, yeah, we've got an EDI strategy. Our focus right now is on gender, or even they might even say, well, it's women in technology or women on boards. You know, they really narrow it down. And next quarter, we'll be focusing on people of an ethnic minority background. And then the year after next, we're going to save the whales. And then we may eventually get round to disability. We're not sure yet, because we're not sure that disability is a priority. So we have those kinds of conversations. And like you say, actually, inclusion is a lot more holistic, because we are all diverse. We're based in the UK. We live in a very diverse country. Diversity exists on our doorstep. It's a conscious act about whether or not we allow that diversity into our organizations. And so, therefore, like the conversations that I like to have with my clients is, how can we shift towards making sure that we're creating equity? Because once we've created that equity, then we can make sure that we've got equality of opportunity. Then we can focus on building that culture of respect, inclusion, and belonging. And at that point, we're going to be in a much better position to attract, recruit, and retain diverse talent in the organization, which is the ultimate goal for many organizations.
Yeah, I think part of the problem sometimes is we're using our own biases and stereotypes and perceptions of people or individuals to make an assumption around their challenge. You know, people maybe look at me and my particular identity and characteristic and make an assumption as to what matters to me or what I think is important. I'm sure you get faced with people who look at you and say, I think I know what Toby's challenges are. But really, beneath the surface, our challenges are subtly different than what people expect, aren't they?
Definitely. I mean, people look at me with a physical disability using an electric wheelchair. And yeah, you're right. They make all sorts of assumptions. One of my diversity heroes is Verna Myers. She was her books was one of the first books that I read when I was entering the EDI space. And if anyone doesn't know Verna, she's an American lawyer by background. She was, until recently, head of diversity and inclusion at Netflix. She's done a couple of really good TED Talks. One of her TED Talks is called Leaning Into Our Biases. And in that, she says that our biases are the stories that we make up about people before we get to know them. And I love using that definition with clients, because it's just so easy to understand. And what she's getting at is that you're right. It's the stereotypes, the assumptions, or the presumptions that people make about you on the surface without really getting to know who you really are.
Yeah. I say one of the biggest challenges I have is being left-handed. You know, that excludes me from far more in life than being trans, you know, being left-handed. You know, I often talk about it. You know, you can't see that in me, but yet it's been a barrier all of my life.
Yeah.
I've had to adapt and overcome by being kind of ambidextrous.
Yeah, I like that left-handed example, because one of the metaphor that I use is the diversity iceberg. So you can see 10% of the iceberg poking above the waterline, and these are our visible characteristics. But 90% of the iceberg is hidden beneath the waterline. And these are our kind of invisible, non-apparent characteristics. And often they're not the traditional types of diversity that we might think about. It's other, like you say, it's other things like, are you left-handed or right-handed? The world has been made mostly for right-handed people. So there's a bias there in terms of right-handedness. But it could all be other things. Are you an introvert? Are you an extrovert? Did you grow up in the countryside or in the middle of the city? These, you know, all of these things shape our outlook on life, our experiences, and things like that.
Yeah, I think what you picked up on there is, if do you fall into the default, you know, in people's blinkers, in people's mindsets? You know, I'm in a arguably a same-sex relationship, it's almost impossible to find mainstream greetings cards from Sainsbury's or, you know, Clinton's or something like that. You walk in and say, I want to find a card for my wife on Valentine's or for her birthday. And it's all cis heteronormative imagery. I've got a friend who is black, and he finds it extremely difficult to find Christmas cards or greetings cards with black representation on it. It's all white imagery. And you think, it's these little things where you don't fit into that default category. And I'm not going to use the word normal. It's just the default in people's heads. You become unconsciously excluded.
Yeah.
People aren't thinking about your need.
Yeah. And those are really good examples of how products have been designed out of bias. So the people that are designing those greeting cards have their own innate biases, and then just not thinking about the diverse representation of characters on greetings cards. And we see it everywhere. We see it in TV programs, film, books. A tiny proportion of children's books include disabled characters or characters who are not white, basically. And if you're a kid and you're reading these books, it's sending you a message that it's kind of creating the othering message. It's saying you're different. And yeah, and somebody said to me the other day, it's a famous quote, you can't be what you can't see. And that's why it's important that we make sure that we've got diversity in organizations. Because if you're aspiring to get to the top of your industry or the top of your company, if you don't have those role models, you can't be what you can't see.
Yeah. And that feeds into sort of like the environmental class of microaggression, where you don't see yourself represented in the media, in imagery, in the world. Therefore, you're constantly oppressed by being an outsider or other, aren't you?
Yeah. And you start to internalize those biases. So when I did my first unconscious bias training when I was working at the BBC as a participant, not as a trainer, I did the Harvard Implicit Association test, and I found out that I was mildly biased against disabled people, which I was shocked about initially. And then when I started looking into why I had this bias, I could understand my own internalized ableism, because I've grown up in a world that's been designed largely by non-disabled people. As a disabled person, I've had to kind of fit into that mold. And growing up, there was just a lack of visible disabled role models in high up in business, in politics, in education, in the film, TV, books that I read. When I worked for the BBC, we did some research, and we found out that disabled people were more likely to be portrayed as villains, victims, and heroes than non-disabled people. So I grew up thinking that disabled people would either become a Paralympic hero, a James Bond villain, because most of them have a disability or some form of disfigurement, or a benefit cheat, because those were the messages that the British media were putting out into society. And these messages then enter the back of your brain as this secret silent script, which then influences how you interact with people in adult life. In my case, it means that I've got this mild bias against disabled people.
It's interesting you mentioned James Bond. I often use the James Bond analogy in all my training that I deliver. And it is, you know, we define James Bond, the character, as good, ideal, protector, white male, straight, womanizer, hero, perfect body figure. And then you say the baddie always has some kind of disability or facial disfigurement or a foreign accent, or all these stereotypes kick in. This is good, this is bad, and it's no wonder. And then we did the same with Disney and female and young women portrayal. This is good, this is bad, this is how women behave, this is how men behave. And we get bombarded with this all the time, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We do. And it shapes our biases. And our biases are formed through the cultures that we grow up in and the experiences that we have. And it affects us on three levels. It affects us in how we think and how we feel. and how we act. And it's a lot harder for us to change the way that we think. So our focus really needs to be on how we act and to change our behaviours to be more.
We've seen a lot, I say the last 18 months, I've seen it a lot more. It seems to be this pushback against wokeism, for whatever that may mean.
Yeah.
It's almost like people who have been marginalised for generations have finally started to achieve equity in society, in the workplace, and their lives. And now people are saying, hang on, we've gone too far. What about me? What about me, the able-bodied white person? I'm being left behind.
Yeah, and we're getting this pushback because it's threatening to them. There's a lot of people who think that if they don't tick, I'll be quite blunt with you, you know, if they don't tick a diversity box or boxes, that they will be at a disadvantage, that somebody will overtake them in their career. That's not what we're trying to accomplish as the professionals that you and I are. I think we're on a mission to create more equity in society. And what do we mean by equity? It's about seeing the individual, understanding what disadvantages they do have, and trying to close the gap so that we do create that equality. Because we don't have equality out of the box, unfortunately. You know, we live in a society where there isn't equality. So we need to focus on closing the gap, and that means starting with equity and giving people the resources and the support that they need to actually help them compete on a level playing field. Because we're not competing on a level playing field at the moment.
Oh, this is also this myth of meritocracy, isn't there? And to quote some government rhetoric, and I've heard it from the new government before they got in and the old government in the UK. So this episode's recorded just post the general election. Where is this belief or this mantra around they want to promote and support hard-working family? What is a hard-working family? I mean, that's laden with bias and meritocracy and stereotyping and trying to create pictures in people's head of what a not hard-working family is, a family that wants to work but can't, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So this meritocracy belief and myth is rampant in all areas of society.
It is. And there's a lot of organisations that say, well, we have a culture of meritocracy. That kind of comment usually comes from the in-group or the majority group who do believe that there is meritocracy, because their experience is that there's fairness, that there's equality, that the best person gets the job. But what they don't understand, I just don't think it's in their kind of sphere of awareness yet. This is a lot about the work that you and I do, is that there are people in an organization that don't share that same experience, that don't have the same type of privileges that the in-group has had, whether that's access to education, speaking English as a first language. There's a whole number of privileges that we hold that create that. And I think talking about privilege, a lot of people get quite defensive about it as a topic, because a lot of people think, well, you know, I had to work really hard to get to where I am now, to my position in the company. And the thing is, nobody's disputing that you did work hard to get to your current position. The thing is, it's about having an understanding that not everyone was gifted with certain things in life that helped accelerate that journey. So I'll just give you a personal example. Like, I've got somebody on my team who's got the same disability as me. The thing is, I grew up in the UK, he grew up in South Africa. And my privileges are that I grew up in the UK, where English is my first language, where I had access to free healthcare, access to free education. The NHS has saved my life on more than one occasion. And the healthcare that I've received from the NHS has enabled me to go off to university and get good jobs and things like that. Whereas my colleague growing up in South Africa didn't have the same access to education as I had. He didn't have the same level of qualifications, which held him back. It meant that he wasn't able to access employment, didn't have access to the same type of healthcare as well, because they have an insurance system over in South Africa. It's very expensive to have the spinal surgery that we've both had. So just the very fact that I was born in the UK, which I had no choice over, that was outside of my control, has actually afforded me many advantages that have effectively given me a leg up in life. And that's what when we talk about privilege, that's what we're really talking about here. It's about the gifts that you've been given that help give you a leg up.
Yeah, I often talk about privilege being a bit like a pension fund. The earlier you've paid into it, the more it's worth as you go through life. And your friend, his pension pot didn't start accruing value until maybe his 30s, 20s and 30s. Your privilege meant that you were depositing into your pension fund from year one. So therefore, yeah, no matter how much this person now has, some of the privileges of society, you will never catch up, or they'll never catch up to you, because you paid in 30 years earlier and you've accrued more privilege as a result of that. And I think that's what we've got to remember, is that also privilege is not around that you can't succeed. It's just harder to succeed because of a part of your identity or upbringing or characteristic.
Yeah, I really like the way that you put it. If it's okay with you, I'll pinch that and use that with some of the conversations that I have with companies.
Feel free. No, I mean, quote me all you like. I'm happy to be quoted. So yeah, but yeah, it is. It's that's the challenge. And I saw something once, someone else's quote, I can't remember who it is now, that when you're used to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And I think that backs up what you were saying, where people are so used to breathing in the air around them, they don't see how smoggy it is a mile away or when they're looking down. And I saw another great analogy where if you're thinking about it as a terrain map, people with privilege are on top of the mountain looking down. Everything looks a very short, small distance. When you're at the bottom of the mountain looking up, everything is enormous. The valleys, the navigation between two points is extreme. Whereas when you're at the top, it looks like one step across. So again, it's your perspective on your environment also is impacted by your privilege and your status in society.
Yeah, I agree.
So you mentioned right at the beginning around this fear of getting it wrong, this saying doing the wrong thing, and it creates this paralysis. And yeah, when I do surveys in my training and my speaking sessions, one of the biggest barriers is the fear of getting it wrong. And you highlighted it there as something you've observed. What do you think causes the fear? And what do you think we can do to take the scariness out of EDI, if you like?
So a lot of the fear of getting it wrong is damage to, I think, your reputation, particularly with senior leaders. I talk to a lot of senior leaders, I think, where they're suffering from imposter syndrome. I was working with a fintech organization, and we do a lot of EDI surveys, you know, where we go in and we ask employees how they feel in the business, whether they feel like they include or whether they feel like they're included or that they belong or not. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the majority of people in the organization, regardless of identity, said that they felt that they did belong in the organization, with the exception of LGBT colleagues. And so we took that information back to one of the company directors, and he said to me, "That's really interesting, but who am I as a straight bloke to be talking about LGBT matters in the organization?" So he didn't understand his role in it. And then after a conversation, he did understand the importance of supporting and being an ally for LGBT staff, even though he didn't identify as being LGBT himself. I think there was a lot of fear about not understanding LGBT matters, using the right language or the wrong language, that kind of thing. But after a conversation with us, he did understand the importance, because as a company director, he's responsible for helping to create the right culture in the business and making LGBT staff feel like they belong.
I think also it's recognizing how you can use your privilege, isn't it? And I think that's what people are scared of. The example I always use is the men allowed women to vote. And that sounds quite provocative and offensive if I say that. But that was a reality in 1918. Men held all the seats in Parliament.
Yeah.
Men were the only people that could vote. And it took an act of Parliament by men, okay, with pressure from suffragettes and women's movements, to change the law. So yeah. Privilege has to open the door. So yeah. men have to tackle sexism. Able-bodied people have to tackle ableism. Straight people have to tackle homophobia or transphobia or biphobia. White people have to solve or tackle racism. So we need the people who hold those privileges to open those doors to make the change, don't we? And I think, but often I've seen it, situations. And there's a person I know who's a man who talks about menopause, and I've seen people on LinkedIn, on Twitter, attack this person, saying, "Well, you're a man. That's all women need. A man talking about menopause." It's like, hang on a minute. We need to create awareness for everybody here.
Yeah. I think what you're talking about there is it's quite important. You need people within to enforce change from within. So an inside out approach. That's not going to happen without outside in pressure. So you were saying about women voting, that the outside pressure was coming from suffragettes and, you know, other movements. But like you say, that change would not have happened unless there were people on the inside who were acting as allies or sponsors, advocates of change. And it does sadden me when you've got people on LinkedIn who are advocates. So you've got men, for example, who are raising the conversation about menopause in the workplace, for example, and they are being an ally and they're advocating for support and change and things like that. And then they're being attacked. That does sadden me. And it's not, it happens in all strands. It happens around LGBT rights. It happens around championing disability rights and things like that.
There was that, I think it was probably 18 months ago or so, maybe even longer. There was that incident with Lady Susan Hussey and that the black charity lady Ngozi Fulani. Lady Susan Hussey was a, I think, part of our Queen's household or something, and she kept asking this Ngozi, where was she from?
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And she got berated for it, and the thing I took away from it was that education should have been the outcome, not public vilification.
My
criticism of the palace excuse me, or the firm, was that they weren't creating the right awareness training. They weren't equipping their representative with the tools, if you like, to converse, cultural intelligence, we would probably call it, wouldn't we, around different people's identities and how to have conversations that aren't necessarily triggering, but also recognising the difference between intent and impact and then being accountable for that. That's what didn't really occur at the time. It was kind of a ploughing on in the face of this discomfort.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because I do wonder if we look at something like the royal family and the palace or the firm, as you put it, I do wonder they probably don't approach EDI in the same way that businesses do. And yeah, I mean, they are at the end, you know, they should operate like a business or an organization, because they are representing people, and they should probably go through the same type of training and have the same kind of EDI strategies as you would expect one of the FTSE 100 companies to have.
Well, yeah, because they hold our global reputation in the power of their words. And to be charitable, I'd like to think that the current king and the slimmed down monarchy, or the slimmed down firm, to me, tend to resonate with a more contemporary communication style and openness and inclusion culture than maybe the generations of the past. We were probably stuck in the Victorian era or the Edwardian era for too long.
Yeah, yeah.
So going back to the sort of fear of getting it wrong, so a lot of it is the nervousness, as being responsible for a big organisation, knowing full well that someone's going to lambast you for those errors. I mentioned the phrase cultural intelligence just now. You're probably well aware that starts with the drive, you know, that kind of, I need to find out more, I need to do better. But that, how do we get people to find that why, to find that drive in the first place?
So the why is really important. And to borrow the words of Simon Sinek, who wrote the book, Start With Why, you have to begin with the why. And I think if you're a senior leader, you need to identify two whys. there's the why for your business, and then there's your why. And your personal why is what's going to motivate you. Thinking about the business why, it's very easy for us to kind of go onto Google or ChatGPT and type in, why is diversity and inclusion important to my business or my industry? And you get back the generic responses like, well, it's good for profitability, it's good for employee engagement, it's good for decision making, it's good for creativity and innovation and all that. And you can go out and you can read the four, I think it's three or four McKinsey reports now, which are kind of worth reading about the business case behind EDI. But you have to translate that into the why for your business. So when I talk to people in healthcare, very often the why is about delivering better patient outcomes, a safer healthcare service, minimizing errors and things like that. That's the why for healthcare, for example. When I worked with a fintech organization, their why was to expand their user base. So they primarily worked with entrepreneurs, providing banking services to entrepreneurs. And they realized entrepreneurs are a very diverse bunch of people, and they wanted to speak to that audience, and they wanted to grow their user base. So the why, you have to understand what your why is for your business and then communicate that throughout the business. Equally, you need to understand your personal why. Sometimes this comes naturally to leaders that I talk to. So I talk to loads of leaders who they'll say to me, I'm really interested in inclusion because my kid has just come out as, you know, as gay, for example. And they're thinking about how their kid is going to fit into the workplace culture of the future. Or they might say, well, my kid's just been diagnosed with autism at school, and I'm worried about whether they're going to be able to access employment in the future. So a lot of senior leaders are driven by or motivated by, say, that kind of thing. But in the absence of that, I think it's really important that you identify what your personal why is. It could be a values-based why. It could be a practical why. So, yeah.
It's almost, I'm going to use the word sad, that you have to have an event that knocks or dents your privilege for you to realise that you had the privilege in the first place, and now you're aware of the needs of others. And yeah, I say it's sad, but I also had that epiphany myself 10 years ago when I embarked on my own gender transition. I suddenly got it. The world changed with that one act for me. You were obviously born into your world and have experienced your why from your pension pot of privileges and or discrimination has been built up for many years. Mine suddenly arrived at my doorstep at the age of 50. And I look back and thought, wow, 50 years, I haven't cared. And then you just got to put that shame and guilt away and go, it doesn't help anybody. And go, what can I do tomorrow? What can I do today? What can I do right now?
Yeah, yeah. It's not until something happens that brings it into our sphere of awareness that we take action. I think that's for anything in life. I think quite often we sail through life, for example, not thinking about our own health. So we drink things that we shouldn't be drinking. We eat food that we shouldn't really be eating. We put on weight. We live with that because it's not debilitating. It's not healthy, but it's not debilitating. And then you have a heart attack and you end up in A&E and the doctor says, oh, you really should start looking after yourself. You really should start eating healthily. And it takes an event like that to knock you. And it just shifts it from that kind of other than consciousness into your consciousness. Consciousness is where the action happens.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, completely. And that's the fundamental reason why McKinsey stats don't work. Accenture, PwC, whatever stats, Deloitte, whatever reports you're going to read, they don't work because we eat too much, we drink too much, we drive too fast, we touch things, we poke around stuff that we know we shouldn't, but we do. Mm. The facts don't change people. It has to be... Something has to get through our armor into our psyche, into our consciousness to go, aha, now I get it. And that's the challenge, isn't it? Going from really understanding your why, not just knowing it's the right thing to do.
well, the why has to be an emotional connection. And this is something that Simon Sinek talks about. And he talks about how difficult it is to connect with the why because it is an emotional thing. It's really difficult for us to put the why into words. When you look at his model, it's like a bullseye chart, you know, so you've got why in the middle, you've got how, and then you've got what on the edge. And he says the what is dead easy. And loads of people, they know how to do the what. They get excited by it. They just go ahead and they do loads of the what. They do loads of stuff. And in terms of the world that you and I work in, that looks like running lots of diversity and inclusion events and designing, implementing lots of EDI initiatives and things like that. And they get very excited by that without understanding actually what's the strategy behind that, which is the how. Are we doing the right things? Are we doing the things that are actually going to make a difference? Are we getting good value for money? Are we going to get a return on investment with our activities? But in the middle, it's the why, which is the emotional bit. That's really, really hard for us to articulate because it's a feeling in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and I also find it's a good challenge to be able to say, okay, you want to have gender greater equity, gender greater parity. Why? Why is that? People look at you as if say, they look almost looking at me as to say, well, you should know. Mm. You're an EDI expert. You should know why. And I said, I do, but I don't need to know why you think it's a good idea for your business and for you personally. Mm. Is it just because when you're at the IOD dinner, you can go, yeah, we're positive gender pay gap? Or is it because you actually believe it's going to benefit your organization at all levels and your customer experience and your shareholder value and not only that as a reason, but also understanding how it contributes to delivering that ROI, isn't it? That's the important thing. Not just having this balance sheet expectation of success.
Yeah, exactly.
So again, going back to this woke, anti-wokeism pushback and this mood that we're seeing at the moment, part of the pushback often is organizations aren't realizing this ROI. Return on inclusion, return on investment, however you want to describe it. Why is that? Why aren't people realizing the ROI?
It's because they don't know how to track it. I had a really interesting conversation. One of the first, I've got my own podcast, and one of the first episodes I ever did was with Peter Cheese, who's the chief exec of the CIPD, Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development. And there was one thing that he said in that interview that really stuck with me, was that a lot of people working in HR are lacking commercial skills. They don't know how to talk business language. They don't know how to go to a board meeting and speak business. And quite often there's a disconnect because board members are like, oh, it's just that, this HR fluffy stuff, like let them get on with the HR fluffy stuff. And then the HR people don't know how to speak the corporate commercial language. Part of that is about your business case. And let me give you an example of what is really powerful. I do a lot of EDI, surveys with companies and things like that. My favorite question is, and I think if I could just have one question in the survey, this would be it. It's, are you thinking of leaving the business in the next 6 months because you don't feel respected for who you are or that you belong? And then you answer yes, but for other reasons. Maybe, no, prefer not to say. And then what we do is we correlate that to salary data and we run that through a cost of attrition algorithm and we can calculate cost of attrition. And just as an example, I did this with a company, a data company. They employed about 900 people, small number of people were seriously thinking of leaving the business. And we ran it through the algorithm and it would potentially cost this organization £1.5 million. So if you take that number to a CFO and you say, look, we got £1.5 million on the table. Shall I just throw that out the window? Or shall we invest £30,000 to try and retain these people to give them a greater sense of belonging? Like, is that a good return on investment? I think most CFOs will go, hell yeah. Let's put 30 grand into this and potentially save ourselves £1.5 million. And that's the kind of data, that's the kind of commercial conversations that we should be having.
Yeah, I did a lot of work in the recruitment sector. And I'm always saying to the people I'm communicating with, you don't start your recruitment project by all the stuff where you are now. You don't. The first thing you don't do is write a job description. What you do is you recruit with retention in mind. So your first objective has to be retention. So what helps you retain good people? Belongingness, culture, values, removing toxicity, psychological safety. So unless you get that bit right first, why do you want to put more fish into a dirty tank? They'll just get fin rot and die. So it's really trying to drill home to people that retention has to be your top priority. Because if you get retention right, less people will leave. They'll be more willing to recommend you. People will see you as a fantastic company. They'll want to join you. They'll want to stay. They'll want to be promoted. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if you start not caring about why people are leaving, then they'll just keep leaving. You just bring them in through this revolving door and it will just cost you.
Definitely. Yeah,
increase tenure by 10%, as you say, save millions.
Yeah, and leaders can think about what we would call the employee value proposition or the employer brand. And there's three, if you imagine a pyramid, there's kind of three levels to the EVP. So at the bottom, you've got your basics, you've got your hygiene factors, so things like, you know, pay, number of hours, that kind of thing. The middle layer is benefits, so access to healthcare, access to gym membership, company car. You need to make sure that those benefits are inclusive, for example. So my personal example is that I've worked for many companies with free health, with private healthcare. I'm immediately excluded because they won't touch anybody who's got a pre-existing health condition. So I'm like, well, that healthcare benefit's no good to me. They didn't think about having a healthcare policy, and they are available, by the way, that covers pre-existing health conditions where I could have benefited from private healthcare. And then at the top of the pyramid, you've got all of the aspirational stuff. And this is things like, you know, connecting people with your values, connecting people with your purpose and your mission and things like that.
It's kind of Hertzberg two-factor theory 101 mixed with a bit of Maslow, isn't it, really? That's all we're talking about.
As is always the case, there's always a mishmash of existing models. We're just repurposing them.
Yeah, with an EDI lens. And I think we often use things like Hertzberg and Maslow and these other kind of models. But as soon as you start shining an EDI lens on them about well-being, I actually say, this is the hygiene. Mm. This is the motivation. And if hygiene's zero, motivation, you can motivate all you like, but hygiene's zero, the performance are going to wane and the environment's going to suck. I'm sorry. Bean bags and pizzas on Friday isn't going to solve toxic workplace where people feel bullied or discriminated.
No, that's funny. I worked for an organization and I used to work with the person responsible for well-being. And companies are saying, oh, we're really worried about people's mental health and well-being. So we're going to provide access to an employee assistance program. We're going to provide free counseling, therapy. We're going to have these like lovely breakout rooms where you can relax in a pod or something like that, you know. And then he was saying, but actually, if you've got a bad relationship with your manager, if you've got too much work to do and that is stressing you out, that's the thing that needs addressing. Like the beanbags and the free coffee in the office and the free basket of fruit and all that kind of stuff just won't cut it. It's the, you need to go back to the root cause.
Yeah, and I don't want to get political, but I look back at how I was viewing the country 6 to 8 weeks ago, or the last 2 years, I found there's been this dark cloud of toxicity, not just because I'm a trans woman, but there was just a general feeling of not wanting to support the wider community. There was almost this dark cloud of anyone who was marginalised or a minority needing equity was being pushed out. EDI initiatives were being thrown out the door. This anti-woke came in, reinforced by the mainstream media. And I kept saying to people, I don't care about the economy. I don't care about mortgage rates. I don't care about interest rates. I don't care about Ukraine. I don't care about Rwanda. What I care about is waking up not feeling unsafe as a human being in my society. And I woke up on Friday morning thinking, regardless who's in government, that's what I want to change. I want to wake up not feeling that I and my friends and people I know are feeling worried about their existence and right to exist. And I think that goes down to the corporate level as well. You know, if you've got that feeling, you're not going to respond and not going to perform.
Yeah, what you're saying really that it reminds me of something, because I interviewed somebody on my podcast called Cynthia, who's a trans woman, and she was saying that we were talking about privileges earlier, weren't we? One of the things that she realized when she kind of talks about the first time that she steps outside her front door and walks down her street, she felt unsafe as a trans woman. And she took for granted, maybe, I don't know if that's the right word or not, but I think she, until that moment, she wasn't aware of feeling unsafe. And like you're saying, like there's been a lot of negative political rhetoric over the last Conservative government, and certainly in the general election campaign. I think a lot of politicians have tried to create divisions rather than unity. And yeah, I mean, just wanting to wake up in the morning and feel safe, I think is a basic need that's really important. I mean, yeah. You know, when I was thinking about who to vote for in the general election, actually, my decision was purely based on which political party I thought would do a better job for disabled people. I wasn't even thinking about the economy or anything like that, even though I should, as an entrepreneur, I should be thinking about the economic policies. But I thought the Conservative government have done such a shitty job for disabled people over the last 10 years. Disabled people there's increase in disabled hate crime. There's, you know, disabled people that are out of work. There's so much inequality for disabled people in British society. I was saying, you know, the number one thing for me was about supporting disabled people, helping them live their best lives.
Yeah, just trying to get us up all several layers on Maslow's hierarchy, get us off the bottom and the second rung up and into the, let's start creating a belongingness and a spirit within us. And
yeah,
and that's what leaders in business have to recognize, that it's just that icky, cloudy, dark feeling that people have. And I don't know if you've seen the film Inside Out or Inside Out 2.
Yeah, I love that.
I'm a great fan of that analogy, because I always used to have this little angry red man in my head driving everything, and then suddenly I found joy, and joy took over. And I think what's happened for me on Friday the 5th of July was joy started flying the plane again. And I'm hoping that is long-lived, not short-lived, and it's not just a honeymoon thing, but I'd like to see that we have this different attitude in society about inclusion, safety, supporting people.
Yeah.
Because to be honest, the economy is the economy. It's not like you can do in a world economy these days. You can't do too much. You can tweak it a bit like the lettuce competitor did. You can tweak it a bit and crash it and send the markets scurrying. But broadly, with the Bank of England and other people, with the fiscal controls out there, you can only tweak the edges, really. It's about the culture you're trying to breed in the country that's going to lift people, create productivity and up our GDP and all those things. It's the culture.
Yeah, it's boosting innovation, creativity, and we get better innovation, better creativity with diverse people working on the problem. You know, one of my clients, they're a consultancy in the energy market, and they're very much moving into the renewable energy space, because that obviously that's the future, and achieving net zero and things like that. And diversity and inclusion is really important for them, because they've realized they cannot solve a big problem like climate change and achieving net zero if you've got the same bunch of people working on the problem falling into groupthink. You need to have those diverse experiences, perspectives, etc., etc. And it will just, you know, if every company took that approach, then it will help. I think it will really help boost our economics.
Yeah, because belonging is all around alignment of vision and values, isn't it? And if we look at the important things for many people today, it's feeling safe, feeling included, psychological safety, but it's also alignment with the planet. If we look at Gen Z, and I'm sure Gen Alpha are going to be like this on steroids, and even some younger millennials are really focused on environmental sustainability, recycling. So the whole language about getting people back into work, making people work twice as hard again, and knuckling down and commuting long distances is against where society was moving in the last 3 or 4 years. So I think we need to go back to this, recognizing we've got to look after ourselves and the planet. And
yeah, that's very industrial. That's almost like very industrial revolution language. It's like, let's get everyone into factories, churning out widgets, working really hard, 9 to 5. We live in a different world now. We're the world of work has changed. We're a lot more creative. We're a lot more innovative. People are not expecting the same job for life like they used to. They want portfolio careers. They want a lot more autonomy over the way they work, whether that's working in like the gig economy or working as a self-employed freelancer or something like that. And there's definitely a trend, and we see this with younger people, of wanting to work for businesses where you've got values alignment. There's some really interesting research that is suggesting Gen Z, for example, are choosing to work for companies with where their values are aligned, and they're actively avoiding those companies that don't have a values alignment. So those companies that are not speaking to the younger generation values, a lot of it around a fair society, a lot of it around greenness and saving the planet, they're missing out on that talent.
Yeah, I have the privilege of working with people who want to work with me because I'm a polarizing person, being transgender. It means that I turn people off and they don't knock on my door. So generally people who do knock on my door know who I am and want to work with me. So I find it really good. So my values tend to align because I self-declare, if you like. So I guess Gen Z is the same. You put it out there and say, I don't need to be something to everybody. I need to be Marmite. I need some people to hate me and some people to like me. Let's work on the people who like me and love me and celebrate me for who I am. That's where we want to be, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Toby, it's been absolutely fascinating. I can't believe the hour's up already. And we had a good chat in the green room beforehand. How do people get hold of you?
The best way is to find me on LinkedIn. I create lots of content every week. Just connect with me on LinkedIn, drop me a message, and we can chat over there.
And you've got a book and you've got podcasts and other stuff as well, haven't you?
Yes, I've actually got 2 books now. So my first book is called Inclusive Growth. And my second book, which came out very recently, is called Building Inclusivity. They're both available on Amazon. I've got a podcast called The Inclusive Growth Show, which you can find on Apple Podcasts and all of the other lovely platforms that are out there. And I interview lots of interesting, fascinating EDI experts, including yourself, Joanne. So go and find Joanne's episode with me.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I'll put all links to all of the stuff I can find in the show notes. And it's been an absolute pleasure spending this hour with you, having a good chat.
Cool. Thanks, Joanne. Thanks for inviting me.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.